Displacement United States History Podcast, episode number 34. Today's topic will be the Cold War, understanding the development of hostilities between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies after World War II. Many of the issues that divided the post-war world were decided at the World War II summit meetings at Tehran in November of 1943, Yalta, February of 1945, and Potsdam, July and August of 1945. President Roosevelt knew of the weaknesses of the League of Nations and believed that only the great powers could ensure peace in the post-war era. In his view, the four policemen, the U.S., Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and China, should assume the responsibility of preventing aggression after subduing the Axis. The movement to found a new league based upon the concept of collective security gathered strength, however, especially in Congress, and the president had little choice but to embrace the scheme. He did succeed in incorporating some of his views in the United Nations. The five great powers, France was added, would become permanent members of the Security Council, the UN's principal executive organ, and the members of the Security, and they would possess a veto over its actions. The Senate of the United States approved membership in the UN in July 1945 by the vote of 89-2. When the Big Three met at Yalta, the main outlines of the conference had already been agreed to at Tehran. The three leaders generally agreed to denazify and demilitarize post-war Germany, but not about how to achieve these goals. Disagreement existed not only between the Allies, but also within the American government. Some leaders believed that while Germany deserved rather drastic treatment, the Allies should not reduce its 60-odd millions to a semi-starvation level. They believed that Germany should have a sufficient economic base to feed itself and play a constructive role in the revival of the European economy. Others believed that the only wise and safe course was to partition Germany and reduce her as close as possible to a pastoral agricultural economy, depriving her of the industrial strength of the war. Roosevelt, while initially favoring the harsh stand, came around to the idea of allowing Germany to rebuild its economy. Stalin favored a drastic policy toward Germany. He particularly wanted heavy reparations in capital equipment, goods, and labor to rebuild his devastated country, and referred to a total of $20 billion as a reasonable amount, with one half going to the Soviet Union. At Yalta, the amount of reparations was left open to a reparations commission, and the question of dismemberment was also postponed. The Allies did agree to divide Germany into zones of occupation, with Berlin jointly occupied. At British wishes primarily, France received an occupation zone carved from the British and American zones. Churchill, unsure of the future U.S. involvement on the continent, thus sought French help in curbing Germany and in watching closely the Soviet Union. The three leaders spent a disproportionate amount of time at Yalta in debate about the future of Poland. To the Soviets, a friendly Poland was absolutely essential. They had been attacked through Poland in 1812, 1914, and 1941 with devastating results each time. Yet Poland was a corridor that ran both ways. The West would not feel comfortable with the Red Army sitting on Poland's western border. In addition, Poland had great psychological significance. Great Britain had gone to war in 1939 over Hitler's invasion of Poland. While many Americans recalled Wilson's role in the creation of the state during World War II, and millions of Polish-American voters had an intense interest in its fate. Unfortunately for the West, geography and military realities meant that only the advancing Soviet armies would free Poland of Nazi control. A Polish government in exile existed in London, and the Soviet government had recognized it after Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union. Stalin insisted, however, that Poland return the area it had taken from the Soviet Union by force in 1921. Churchill and FDR urged the Polish government in vain to recognize the realities of Soviet power and the imperative necessity of quickly striking an agreement with Moscow. The Poles would be compensated with German territory from the west to make up for the territory they lost to the Soviet Union in the east. When the Poles refused to agree to the Soviet demands, Moscow broke relations with the exile government in 1943 and subsequently installed in Warsaw a communist-dominated Polish government. Even before the defeat of Germany, a rift had begun to emerge within the Grand Alliance. When Italy surrendered in 1943, the Soviets were excluded from any participation in the peace talks and subsequent terms. Thus, the Italian government was allowed to surrender with conditions, to stay in power, to retain administrative control of non-battlefield areas in Italy, to keep the monarchy, and eventually join the Allies as a co-belligerent. The end result was that by 1945, the same groups that had run Italy before the war were still in power, backed by an Allied control council from which the Soviets had been systematically excluded. Stalin had protested initially but did not press the point, for he seems to have recognized the value of the precedent. Those who liberated a country from the Nazis could decide what happened there. He was more than willing to allow the Allies to shape the future in Italy in return for the same right in Eastern Europe. On May 11, 1945, after the German surrender, President Truman ordered a drastic curtailment in lend-lease aid to the Soviet Union. Ships were even recalled that were already en route with cargoes of aid for Russia. Although Truman countermanded the order, the Soviet Union still had to fight Japan. This action deeply offended Stalin, who viewed it as an example of American bad faith, an attempt to coerce the Soviet Union into following policies favorable to the United States if it wanted to continue to receive aid for a post-war recovery program. After the war ended, the Soviet Union began to organize and dominate the areas along its borders. In Eastern and Central Europe, this meant a sphere of influence in countries that the Red Army controlled: Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, and East Germany. With the exception of Czechoslovakia, prior to the war, these countries had been ruled by right-wing dictatorships hostile to the Soviet Union. Probably Russia, under Tsarist, communist, or any other form of government, would have pursued rather similar goals after 1945. Security and traditional national goals were more important than ideology in the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe. Probably at no time did Stalin plan a communist takeover of all Europe, much less the whole world. Apparently, he viewed foreign communist movements with much skepticism and distrust, fearful they might escape his control, and he was cynically prepared to use them and to sacrifice their interests for the good of the Soviet Union. He looked askance on Josip Tito's communist government in Yugoslavia and Mao Zedong's communist movement in China. He refused to directly help the Greek communists in their attempt to overthrow the Greek government. Stalin apparently was ready to accept the existence of Western spheres of influence in return for the acceptance of his own. He probably believed that the negotiations at Tehran and Yalta had arrived at an agreement or understanding about the Soviet sphere in Eastern Europe. FDR and Churchill had conceded the desirability of friendly governments along the Soviet Union's borders, but they had not conceded the complete Soviet dominance and communization of the countries of Eastern and Central Europe. The Americans especially thought that it was possible to have East European governments that were both capitalistic and friendly to the Soviet Union. As Secretary of State James Burns put it, "Our objective is a government in Poland both friendly to the Soviet Union and representative of all democratic elements of the country." It was an impossible program. The division of East European society into elites and masses precluded democratic capitalism, and no capitalistic government in the region could be other than anti-Soviet. The West was shocked and felt betrayed by the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe. Although it was obvious that Stalin was cooperating in the attempt to restore worldwide stability by refusing to aid the communists in Greece, Italy, France, China, and elsewhere, Americans came to believe that he was a would-be world conqueror. He was seen as another Hitler, and Americans remembered how appeasement had failed in preventing Hitler's expansion. Time and again, Stalin emphasized the Soviet Union's desire for security, her need to protect herself from Germany and the capitalistic West by controlling the nations on her border. But increasingly, Americans dismissed his statements as lies and denounced him as a paranoid whose aim was world conquest. The flames were fed by millions of American voters of East European origin, aided by the Catholic Church, businessmen who wanted access to the region's markets, anti-communists in the State Department, and military men who were sincerely worried about the new strategic balance in Europe. A kind of panic swept over the U.S. One of the first of those to feel the panic was President Truman. In January 1945, Stalin requested a $6 billion post-war recovery loan for the Soviet Union. The U.S. State Department refused to discuss the matter unless Stalin became more receptive to U.S. demands in Europe. Later in 1945, the Soviets asked for a $1 billion loan. The official U.S. government explanation to this day was that they lost the request. When it was found months later, the State Department offered to discuss the loan if the Soviets would pledge non-discrimination in international commerce, allowing U.S. investment in goods into the Soviet sphere of influence. At the same time, the U.S. loaned Great Britain nearly $4 billion and France $1 billion for recovery measures. Stalin rejected the U.S. conditions and instead announced a new five-year plan to rebuild the Soviet Union. That's all for today. Please join us next time for episode number 35, The Cold War. We'll be looking at the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan.